This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Ever had to stand in an unemployment line? What was that like? Even if you've never been there yourself, with the economic doldrums of the past 4 years, chances are good you know someone who's been out of work for a significant period. And significant period is the key phrase. New records are being set for the number of Americans experiencing long-term unemployment. Two Virginia economists decided to look deeper into this phenomenon. Their findings turned out to be the focus of a high-profile session recently in the halls of Congress. We've asked them to share those same findings with us, including their thoughts about solutions. But if you have a perspective on what it feels like to be out of work, or what should be done about joblessness, we're hoping you'll be willing to share your insight, too, right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. The new study is officially titled Revisiting the Long-Term Unemployment and Mental Health Causality Quandary. And as intimidating as that title might sound, the report has some very basic, easy-to-follow findings about what is going on in America beneath the surface of unemployment. Two of the study's co-authors are with us this hour, and we'll hear from them in just a moment. But we also want to stress that your experience, understanding, or even ideas for solutions in dealing with unemployment are invited. By phone, you can reach us at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Online, you can post to us on Facebook, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Timothy Diette is lead author of the new study. His colleague Art Goldsmith is one of the co-authors. Both are economists by profession, and both serve on the faculty at Washington and Lee University. Thank you, gentlemen, both for making time for us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here, Tom.
Tim Diette, starting with you, if I could. What is it you would like people to understand about the effects of unemployment that you suspect they may not understand?
Well, I think it's often challenging to really wrap our heads fully around the significant costs of unemployment and to really understand both the immediate or short-run impacts of that unemployment. So the monetary, right, the loss of the wages being what we think of primarily. But then to appreciate that if I'm out of work for a longer period of time, there starts to be several different things that could happen. There's both the stress mentally, the effects that's going to have on the family, as well as what's happening to the actual, what economists call human capital, but essentially the skills that employers value in you. And so really trying to understand and appreciate the full costs of being unemployed and therefore informing policymakers about trying to reduce that.
Yeah, exactly, that there are both monetary and non-monetary costs associated with involuntary joblessness. And we should be aware of that when thinking about policy and how to respond to a situation like we're currently in now.
Cost to whom?
Well, there are certainly societal costs. When the economy is experiencing lots of unemployment, we're generating a lower GNP. There's less output. There's less economic development. That's problematic. But, of course, there's also individual costs, and that's where Tim was talking about the emotional consequences of joblessness, not just to the individual directly, but to people around them as well, family members and colleagues, friends,
right,
et cetera.
And to the extent that the unemployment might be concentrated in particular communities, really the health of entire communities, particularly when we think of, you know, within Virginia, many smaller towns or cities where if one large plant goes out of work and you have a large number of people, right, that's going to have a really lasting effect on the community and the overall quality of life in the community.
Absolutely.
So if you could, Tim Diep, paint a picture for me of just one of what I'm sure, based on your research, you could come up with thousands of examples. But say there's a woman named Mary, and she has two young children, and she's been working at a call center somewhere in central Virginia, and that call center job goes away because the company that was doing it found that they could do it more cheaply in some place like India. What Mary loses her job. In this economy, she's having a terribly hard time finding another one. What kinds of costs are we talking about to her, to people related to her, to the community she lives in, and to the society as a whole?
Well, boy, it's a long list. So I'll start off and I'll let Art jump in with some of the other costs. You can think sort of immediately just her own health, and both physical health, mental health, the effect of any spouse she may have or a partner, the effect on her children.
Tell me about those effects.
Sure.
What's likely to happen to her physical health, to her mental health, to her children?
All of that could certainly be affected, one, through diet, another through access to medical care. So suddenly they have, experienced some sort of episode and they don't feel comfortable going to a doctor.
Lost their insurance.
Right. They may not feel comfortable. They might even be eligible for Medicaid, but they are nervous about the stigma of applying for Medicaid and getting that sort of support. In terms of their children, again, it could be the effects of, there's clear research that documents the effects of sleep and nutrition on academic performance. Also, as well, you could imagine that they may, if this is a long stretch of unemployment, lose their house. That may force the children to then relocate to another school district. Maybe the apartments that she's able to afford is going to be in a less desirable school district. And that's just for starters.
Absolutely. The entire social fabric of society is impacted by a period like we're in now where there has been sustained very high levels of long-term unemployment. In terms of the kids, yes, switching school districts affects academic performance. Studies show that children in families with unemployed parents exhibit high levels of stress, which is detrimental to performance in school, to say the least. Marriages, there's much higher divorce rates, Tom, during periods of high unemployment. So there's a lot of factors that are going on in society that are adversely affected by a long and sustained downturn like we're in now.
So to you who are listening, we're asking for your perspective on everything that gets touched on here today. And I'm curious how the economic downturn over the past 4 years or even more may have affected you or affected people you know, or has it not really affected you or anyone you know at all? 888-WMRA. Talk is how to reach us by phone. That's 888-967-2825. Washington and Lee University economists Tim Diet and Art Goldsmith are our guests. They are among the co-authors of a new study examining the hidden costs of unemployment across America. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Several weeks ago, Art, you took the highlights of this new study to Washington and did what with it?
Well, I met with House legislative aides, senior legislative aides, to talk to them about the causes and consequences of long-term joblessness, because Alcee Hastings from Florida is concerned that, A, we don't know enough about all the costs that Tim was just describing, especially the non-monetary costs, and that, second, if we are going to engage in policies that we would hope would be effective in addressing unemployment, that we need to know more about the sources of unemployment. So I went and spoke with these legislative aides who meet regularly with their bosses, who are congresspeople, about the causes and consequences of joblessness.
So I have a copy of your testimony here in front of me, and there are two paragraphs that at this moment, they're not immediately next to each other, so I'm hoping I'm going to read in the correct order here. In the middle of one paragraph, quote, "The average period of unemployment has stretched to 23 weeks or close to half a year in length. This is unprecedented. It is the longest average duration since the Bureau of Labor Statistics began reporting a mean duration in 1948. And then skipping forward a couple of pages, where you said in this hearing, Art Goldsmith, quote, "Those who were unemployed 26 weeks or longer, the long-term unemployed, are three times as likely as those who worked through the past year to suffer from significant psychological distress." So in essence, what you're saying is there's a huge number of people who are not only unemployed, but they are experiencing longer unemployment than ever before in our kept records.
Absolutely.
And that as people do that, something really detrimental happens, at least to their psychological health.
Right. Well, we've created the perfect storm for psychological distress through the labor market over the last few years. You know, we had a downturn, a recession from 2007 to 2009. It was the biggest downturn we've had since the Great Depression. It was an enormous decline in GDP. The unemployment rate rose from 5% to over 9%. But the staggering thing is the increase in long-term unemployment, wouldn't you say, Tim, relative to short-term unemployment?
Yes.
And part of this whole story is, how do people become unemployed? You know, we always have two kinds of unemployment in a society. And this particular situation, we're piling on a third kind. One type is called frictional unemployment. And these are people that have the skills that employers want. They're new entrants, re-entrants, job changers. They're searching for work. They're unemployed for a short period of time. Half of those bouts end in less than 5 weeks. You don't see a lot of adverse psychological consequences for these folks. There's been a lot of discussion in the past year or so about the second type of unemployment I wanted to address, which is called mismatch unemployment or structural unemployment. And that's where people don't seem to have the skills that employers want. And that's a perfect situation that can generate feelings of helplessness and adversely affect psychological well-being. So how do people become structurally unemployed? Well, it happens primarily in two ways. There's technological change, which we're seeing rapidly in our society. That tends to generate jobs for high-skilled people and curtail jobs for those that are less skilled. And also globalization or offshoring. And we're seeing lots of that as firms decide that we're not going to produce these products domestically. We're not relatively good at that. We'll let that go. There's been a lot of globalization, lots of increasing trade. And when people lose their jobs through globalization and technological change, they tend to blame themselves. They're thinking, geez, maybe I should have gotten a different kind of education, or maybe I should have done something to protect myself from these kinds of events in life. That self-blame can really damage psychological health.
But in this new report, Art, if I recall correctly, you say that the frictional unemployment, which if I understand correctly is in essence that employers are looking for a particular kind of employee and the people with those skills are out there, but it takes a few weeks for the employer and the potential employee to find each other. So that leads to about, on average, 5 weeks of unemployment. And then the structural that you were just talking about is that employers are looking for people who have skills that the unemployed don't seem to have, so they have to get retrained before they can compete for that job.
Exactly.
In this report, you say that that only makes up, on average, 4 to 5% of total unemployment in the U.S. throughout history. Until recently, we were above 9% unemployment for many months, and we're still just a little below 9%. So that sounds to me like there are an awful lot of other people who are unemployed for some other reason.
Right. And that third reason is just what we call deficient demand or a lack of spending, and it works pretty simply. You get a situation where spending starts to fall. Firms get a little nervous about that. They see their inventories rising. They cut production. When they cut production, they typically are laying people off. Household incomes are falling. People start spending less. They spend less. Firms cut production again. So you get a retreat going that's cyclical or feeding upon itself. And the next thing you know, there's a lot less spending going on in society and unemployment is rising. And that's what's accounted for the other 3.5% to 4% that we're seeing right now.
So to you who are listening, have you ever been unemployed for any significant period of time? If you have been, are you willing to share with us a little bit about what that experience is like? Or do you know the story of somebody else? Or even if you want to protect confidentiality for yourself, you could frame your story in the case of it being a friend of yours. But we really want to hear some personal experience. The phone number is coming up. Bruce Hornsby, a clip from The Way It Is. We're wondering what the way it might be in your world, in the world of anybody who has been having troubles because of the economic downturn. Somebody who's been unemployed for a period of time, somebody who's been underemployed, working part-time when you'd rather work full-time, but you can't find a full-time job. Somebody who's had a job and throughout the past 4 years of economic downturn has kept that job, but at times been feeling like you're hanging on by your fingernails because you never know when the other shoe is going to drop. Our call-in phone number is 888-WMRA-TALK, 1-888-967-2825. Our guests, Art Goldsmith, who's written extensively for any number of scholarly journals about labor economics, human resources, and the psychology of job loss. He is the Stevens Professor of Economics at Washington and Lee University. And Tim Diet, who serves both on the economics faculty at Washington and Lee, as well as in that school's Shepherd Program for the Study of Poverty and Human Capability. Both of them are among the co-authors of a new study examining the hidden costs of unemployment. And I'll just do my sympathy pitch. You may think that I'm talking like this today just because I am trying to make my voice extra deep and sexy and resonant. The fact of the matter is that I am losing my voice. So I've asked Tim and Art to talk to each other as much as possible to have sympathy on that way. But in the interest of my not losing my voice completely before the end of the hour, if you wanted to ask a question, all the phone lines are open at 888-WMRA-TALK. What should we be doing that we are not doing about unemployment? Tim?
Well, I mean, that's, again, a broad question, and we could think of quite a few different things. I think.
Well, I'm trying to ask questions.
Sure.
Just you guys will talk for the rest of the hour,
there
and I won't have to say anything again
here
with my super sexy deep voice.
Well, certainly, I think the elephant in the room is the entire debate we have going on in Washington and all around the country right now, and that's around the debt and the deficit and government spending and what's the appropriate role and what policies should we be doing. Same. And I think what this research hopefully fills in is just a little bit more as far as when we think about these costs of unemployment, that as we think about, well, the costs and benefits of the debt, and is that a cost we're willing to take on, to really understand that why are so many economists out there talking about, well, we want to deal with the deficit and the debt, but not today. And it's not just that we don't like going on a diet today, like most individuals might want to wait and do that tomorrow. In this case, there's a very good case for waiting to do that tomorrow.
Right.
Because while it's obvious and clear, and we can look at a debt or a deficit number and we see, oh, well, I don't want that number to go up, so instead I might want to raise taxes or I might want to cut government spending. Instead, we also need to think, well, if we do that, what effect are we having on unemployment?
Yeah. Look, as Tim pointed out, we're having historically high unemployment because of a lack of spending. And you have to ask yourself, well, where will we be able to fill that spending? What is going to be the source of an increase in spending so that we can go back to a situation where we're at about 5% unemployment, where the unemployment is all frictional and structural, which we call full employment, believe it or not? Well, there's only four sources of spending: consumers, businesses on plant and equipment called investment, the public sector, and export spending. And the news is pretty sobering right now. You know, consumers or households lost an awful lot of paper wealth with the decline in the economy, decline in the stock market. They're very loath to start spending right now outside of the holiday season. Firms still have a fairly gloomy perspective of their long-run profit perspectives over time, so they're not spending increased amounts on plant and equipment. The U.S. dollar is relatively strong, so that doesn't look like a great source of increase in export spending, and therefore a lot of attention has been focused on the government as a spender of last resort to get the spending going, to prime the pump, to get the economy moving so that we can have an expansion. And, of course, that feeds into this national conversation, as Tim pointed out, we're having about budget deficits. So that it kind of raises the question of where did the budget deficit come from?
Right. And from there, you know, if we look at data, and we can look at Europe as well, You know, a lot of the nations were actually, if you look in the early 2000s, were doing quite well in terms of their overall deficits. They either were running small deficits or, in the case of the U.S., even a surplus before the Iraq War and the tax cuts that we passed. And so a lot of it really is simply the collapse of tax revenue, right? Because it's really important to understand that direct connection between the overall health of the economy and tax revenue. And if people aren't making money, if corporations aren't making money, then those tax coffers are going to be, it's going to be drying up. And so that is certainly the source of a lot of this shortfall. And
so wait a minute. Let me see if I understand, Tim Diet. A lot of the political rhetoric today is that the economy is so bad because the government is spending too much money. There's too much interference from Washington in terms of regulation, and there's too much choking off of the economy because of government spending. And it sounds to me like what you're saying is pretty much just the opposite, is that it isn't that we have such a huge deficit because government is suddenly spending a whole heck of a lot more. What's happened is that in 2007, the housing bubble began to burst. There were all kinds of problems on Wall Street that led to freezing of credit, and companies stopped hiring and started laying off. And as all those people, those millions of people across America were losing their jobs, the tax revenues went down. So it wasn't that the government suddenly shot up its spending. It just found a hole in its pocket in terms of bringing any revenue in because so few people compared to before were paying taxes?
Yes, I think that pretty much sums up the position, I think, of a lot of folks. Now, that's not to say that you can't have discussions about the appropriate levels of regulation, and you could have, okay, maybe we're over-regulated at the moment. But to suggest that there was a dramatic change in regulation, I think goes against what we simply see empirically or as essentially as fact. Yeah. So that could be something you want to change, but I don't think you want to say it's an
effect.
So
it sounds to me like the two of you are from the camp of economists that there seem to be a lot of, but we don't hear from too often, who are saying this is actually the time when the government should be spending more. You're nodding your heads. I want to ask
Absolutely.
You more about that, but we're
yeah.
getting phone
Absolutely.
Calls now. So let me get some of the phone calls, and we'll get back
sure.
to that. Nathan in Broadway is joining us here on Virginia Insight. Nathan, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please, for economists Tim Diet and Art Goldsmith.
Yes. Well, I've been unemployed for a good long time, and I always work jobs that paid not good, not best in the world. And I went in to an interview to a restaurant for a dishwashing job. I'll wash dishes. I have no problem. And the lady looked at me and said, well, why should I hire you? I have 20 people that came in here today that all have restaurant experience. And I'm like, really? I just need a job. I don't care what I have to do. So what? This is minimum wage. It's close enough to where I live. And it just kind of stumped me because you were talking before about mismatch of skills. There's some of us that have never done the lower, restaurant and that kind of stuff work because we never had to. Then we go to apply to it, and then, the economy's so bad, that industry's now flooded almost. And thank goodness for my dad, and I'm able to hunt and can and some other things, or else I wouldn't be eating.
Your story, unfortunately, is all too common today. In 2007, we had about 4 million people unemployed. Today, we have over 14 million people unemployed. There's 7 people searching for work for every job that's listed. So,
let me see if I understand those figures. In reading this new report of yours and Tim's, Art, it seemed to me that the 14 million was the combination of unemployed and underemployed, or is 14 million just people who don't have jobs at all?
The 14 million are people that are actively searching for work and don't have jobs. So the 4 million would be the frictional and the structural unemployment together, and the additional 10 million or so is due to deficient spending, and that's the situation that our caller is really describing.
Nathan, would you be willing to share with us what kind of work you used to do?
I used to do a lot of warehouse and production work. And, you know, like I said, it never paid all that well, but it was always better than working, you know, minimum wage at a restaurant. And now that all the jobs are gone, you can't really get even in the door because you're still competing against people that have more experience working at a restaurant. I have some schooling in photography and stuff, but newspapers and whatnot, and that just, you just don't want to even go to that mess. But it's just, it's very hard to even get into, it seems like to me, and this isn't the first time it's happened, into even the lower jobs because you've never done it before. Yeah. And you're competing against people that have.
Yeah, Nathan, this is Tim. Thank you so much for your call. I mean, I think, you know, your call is so important in several ways. One, it represents the issue that it's not about people being lazy out there that are unemployed. As Art mentioned, right, you've got the six or seven people looking for that one job. And in addition, you have this cascading effect of, you know, people who originally would have had, you know, they have all these skills. They're all moving down the food chain, per se, in terms of, you know, maybe job skills. And you're, you know, an example of someone who, right, you have skills for another job, but you're now moving down and trying to find any work. And so it becomes this, essentially this huge competition. And, yeah, there's simply too many people looking to the number of jobs. And so, and the other point that I wanted to add was to the statistics that were mentioned earlier, that it's really critical that we keep in mind all those that have given up looking. I mean, that's great, Nathan, that you're still out, you know, looking for any of these jobs. But, you know, a lot of folks do get so discouraged that they don't report. And keep in mind that when we look at unemployment data, that's all based on when you answer that phone for the phone call, do you say, yes, I've applied for a job within the past few weeks? If you haven't, you're not counted as unemployed.
Right.
You're simply out of the labor
right.
force.
And the actual unemployment rate, as Tim's pointing out, would be almost 5% higher if we counted in those people that just became so discouraged they stopped searching for work.
Nathan, thank you so very much for sharing your perspective with us. We do wish you the best of luck. Don't know how much it's going to help, but all of us here are rooting for you. One of the things that Nathan's comments remind me of, Tim Diet and Art Goldsmith, is some of the things that you point to happening with people who are long-term unemployed that it sounds like Nathan is not allowing to happen to him, at least so far. He mentioned that he still has a connection with his dad and he's allowing his dad to help him, that he's out hunting and canning food and gardening. One of the things that you talk about in this report, Art, is the degree to which people who are unemployed for any significant period of time begin to isolate themselves.
Absolutely, which is the worst case scenario you can imagine. They do socially isolate themselves because it is hurtful and it is embarrassing to people like Nathan who've been working and taking care of themselves and their family for sustained periods of time to all of a sudden struggle in the labor market. And that is certainly of concern. I would go back to Bruce Hornsby and say, well, maybe that's the way it is, but it doesn't have to be that way. And that's why a lot of the conversation now is maybe this should be a period where we should have an additional stimulus program and then worry later about the deficit and bringing it down. Because the main thing that drives the deficit is the growth of the economy. When the economy tanked and went into a recession, as Tim pointed out, tax revenues fell dramatically, and all of a sudden the budget deficit became a huge issue. If we can turn this boat around and the economy starts to grow, and that's only going to happen as we get more spending and more employment, then tax revenues will rise dramatically and we'll be back into a surplus. And we ran surpluses throughout the Clinton years. Otherwise, they wouldn't have run those shows on Saturday Night Live about the lockbox.
Cynthia, we'll get to your call in just a moment, but for anybody who's just joined us, I just want to point out that the new report we're discussing is titled Revisiting the Long-Term Unemployment and Mental Health Causality Quandary. It is the work of researchers in New York, North Carolina, and Virginia. The two Virginia co-authors are here with us, economists Timothy Diet and Arthur Goldsmith. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. If you'd be willing to join the conversation, we have some phone lines open at 888-WMRA-TALK, 888-967-2825. The talk show host is looking for as much help as possible before his voice goes away completely. Cynthia, thank you for calling in from McGackiesville and being willing to offer that help. Your question or comment, please.
Yes. I am a mother of a son who has two babies. He's married. Recently, his wife lost her job. His job cut back his hours so much that he might work twice a week, maybe Saturday or Sunday. They've cut him back that much. They lost their car. And therefore, now, how are they going to get back to work? I have been financing them long distance. They're finally homeless. They were, they were kicked out of their house or their apartment New Year's Day. I had to call up my family, and they split up. So she's with the babies and her family. He's with my family. I'm financing him long distance, and, you know, I guess her family's helping her whatever way that she can, they can. In the meantime, I've called down there. I've even asked him, my son, to go to social services to see if they can help them. He was told, both of them were told, that the only way they can get help is if she was a single mom. Does that make sense? The government is willing to pay a woman who has children to stay in an apartment, set them up nicely. I went down there. He showed it to me. I had to see it firsthand because I couldn't believe it was happening. In the meantime, there's a responsible man willing to work 12 hours a day, have a wife who is a CNA. She can't go to work now because she has to stay home and take care of the kids. He's training to be a CNA so that maybe it'll bump him up another dollar because he was getting minimum wage. I just don't understand how the government, starting with the state, the county, on up, is allowing this type of program where you are disqualified as a family, but you can be qualified as a woman with children. She can have them from whoever she wants.
Cynthia, hold on for a second. Let's get some response from our guests.
Well, it's a terrible shame what you're describing, and there's no doubt that one of the things we see in this recession is as government tax revenue has cascaded down, the block grants to state and local communities to provide services have really cut back dramatically. And there's just tremendous excess demand for services, and they have to decide how are we going to allocate the limited resources we have. And some of the things they may be doing seem senseless to those of us who are looking at this from the outside. And what you're describing is a tragedy, to say the least.
And I understand that you're not a psychologist. You're an economist who's looked at the research that includes the psychological impacts. But is there anything practical that you can recommend that somebody like Cynthia or someone like her son try that maybe they haven't thought to try so far?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. You're asking the question, what can buffer the adverse psychological consequences of long-term joblessness? And I wish there was a magic bullet, to say the least. But one of the things we see is that unemployed people whose parents are alive, when they have relationships with them, the parents are able to help them in two ways. One with resources.
Hold on. We'll get to that in a moment. From the song Blue Collar Man by Styx, does that reach a chord for you? If you'd be willing to share any of your chords of experience with us, phone numbers 888-WMRA. Talk with us, Washington and Lee University economists Tim Diet and Art Goldsmith. They are among the co-authors of a new study examining the hidden costs of unemployment. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. And before we so rudely cut you off to go to the break, Art Goldsmith, you were saying that there were two things that you think people in Cynthia's position, our caller on the line from McGackiesville, might benefit by knowing?
Absolutely. Cynthia is the model parent. She's providing both financial and emotional support for her child who's struggling. And the important thing to recognize is that your child, your offspring, is doing everything they should be doing. And I know that there's oftentimes a sense that the unemployed are flawed characters, but indeed they're not at all.
Yeah. And really what this all speaks to is, I mean, the policy that Cynthia mentioned is, I mean, that's the way it is. And it's intentionally designed that way in the sense that there's this unspoken assumption that the unemployed, it's that it's their own fault. And if you have a family that's intact, the maybe husband or at least one of the partners should be going out there and getting a job, which, you know, as Nathan mentioned earlier, you know, going out and getting that dishwashing job, that'd be available when the economy is booming. And so that policy might be fine in a normal economy, but we are certainly not in a normal
economy.
So
what I think I was hearing you say also during the break, Tim, is that the kind of policy that Cynthia was talking about, where if a man wasn't able to find a job as a head of a household, he wasn't going to get any help. His wife and the kids could get help if they got divorced and then she became a single mom. That was based on an understanding from years past where any man who wanted the job ought to be able to find one, even if it was a dishwashing job.
That's right. I mean, that was really passed in the mid-90s.
1996.
Right, the 96, the TANF, right, where we changed from traditional welfare to the temporary aid for needy families.
But as our previous caller, Nathan, was just pointing out, is somebody in his position, he's willing to take any job. And apparently Cynthia's son is willing to take any job. But no matter what they're willing to do, the jobs just aren't there.
Sure. Yes. And Nathan's a perfect example of a lack of spending. He was working in the warehousing industry, right? And those jobs are the kinds that go away when spending falls and people aren't purchasing as many goods and services and warehouses are experiencing less activity.
Yeah. And the other part for me is that, you know, both the callers that we've had, you know, have those buffers, have that support network. And I, you know, worry about those individuals out there who don't have that support network. You know, and this, and the other part is that it shows the effects of that Cynthia, right, as far as the stress that she's feeling as well.
Absolutely. Cynthia, thank you again for taking the time to share your experience with us. And again, we wish you the best of luck. Next, we're going to Paul, who is in his truck somewhere. Paul, thanks for calling in on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for Tim Diet and or Art Goldsmith, please.
Yeah, thank you. I just had a small comment or question. If maybe there's a percentage of people out there, and my sister in Waco, Texas, as well as her boyfriend, they're both on unemployment. And I've argued back and forth with them time and time again. They keep on telling me that the jobs that are out there, their unemployment is actually paying more than the job would. So they're going to stay on it as long as they possibly can, which, you know, makes me sick. But, you know, nevertheless, that's what they do.
Mm-hmm. Well, a few things. First, unemployment compensation is not terribly generous in the United States relative to other developed countries. It's at most about 50% of what your prior pay was. And you can only stay on it for typically a relatively short period of time. But we've changed the law because of the massive recession, this great recession we've been in, and you can stay now up to 99 weeks. So if it's the case that the jobs that they were in were well-paying jobs, and now the only jobs available are in the service sector, then the pay might be low enough that they're almost equivalent. But, of course, they'd rather be working, I'm sure, by and large, because it builds self-esteem. It gives you something to do. It organizes your day. It gets you out there interacting with other people. And these latent byproducts of work are very important to us as human beings and feeling like we're part of something bigger than ourselves.
Yeah, and Paul, this is Tim. I appreciate your comment, and I think that you certainly, you know, the view that they should be taking the job does represent the view of a large number of Americans, and I think it is the challenge of coming up with the appropriate unemployment compensation and what are the right policies, because that is a real problem, that you don't want to provide such an incentive that individuals do not go out and look for jobs. That's certainly less of a problem right now, typically.
Paul, is it, as Art was, I think, implying that he sees in some situations, where your sister and brother-in-law are saying that the quality of paying jobs is so low, that what they pay is so low, that it doesn't beat what they're already getting from unemployment, and that they used to have much better-paying jobs, but they can't find anything along the lines of what they used to have?
Well, yeah, they did have really good-paying jobs. and I don't know the whole entire story of it, but as far as I know, they're getting food stamps plus their unemployment, and they're saying thank God for Barack Obama because they get more weeks now. And,
but your perspective is, if I understand correctly, Paul, that, that even if they had to take a minimum wage job that ended up giving them less money than what they're getting from their unemployment checks and far less than they used to earn in their old jobs, that, that you think it would be more honorable for them to take those minimum wage jobs?
Well, I totally agree, you know, but I just can't get them to get out there and get those jobs. They don't want to.
Paul, thank you so much for sharing your perspective. Somewhere in our audience is someone who is absolutely convinced that the reason unemployment is so high right now is because government spending is too high. Somewhere else in the audience, someone who believes what government needs to be doing right now is spend more in efforts to curb joblessness. So what I'm wondering is, are you there listening? Either one of those people. By phone, we are at 888-WMRA-TALK in all numbers. That translates to 888-967-2825. On Facebook, you can find us listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Next, we're going to Stanton. Sam, thank you for joining us. Your question or comment, please.
Yeah, it's pretty much a comment. You know, I think that a big problem with the joblessness and the you know, lack of jobs in the open market is the fact that we have cut millions and, you know, millions of jobs from the government and public sector. And what those jobs do is they kind of offer, you know, a balance to public sector because you have good health care, you have a pension. You're guaranteed that if your skills increase, that you are paid more for them. You know, and so now we have what jobs are available are so cutthroat because not only do you have the unemployed that have worked private sectors their whole life, but folks in the public sector that have worked for government their whole lives and now they don't have a job.
You know, Sam, you're spot on. Look, when the government is in an area as an employer and they have a high standard in terms of the ways in which they treat employees, the private sector has to step up to the plate and compete with them. It's called a spillover hypothesis or effect, and scientific evidence from the best scholars is totally consistent with your view. And when the government dries up as an employer, the private sector is left in a situation where they can offer fewer benefits or lower quality benefits, including lower wages, not just fringe benefits. So what you say is absolutely spot on.
Yeah. Sam, thank you so much for your call. Art and Tim, have we not been here before? And in terms of what went on with the Great Depression back in the 1930s, wasn't there a focus first, the idea that what government had to do was cut spending? And then that turned around. Or am I misremembering my history?
Well, a few things happened during the Great Depression. Looking back, you know, we're being armchair quarterbacks now. We really screwed up, to say the least. We did a few things. We, in terms of monetary policy, we actually engaged in a contractionary monetary policy, which made matters worse. So in other words, when the banks were closing, rather than helping them, we were standing by on the sidelines, and that was problematic. And there was certainly a movement then, as well as now, for lower government spending because tax revenue was falling. So both in terms of the two main levers we have for policy to assist the economy— fiscal policy and monetary policy, we're acting in ways to exacerbate the recession.
So when I ask the question, have we not been here before, it seems to me that there are a number of instances in U.S. history, including the Great Depression, where much as what seems to be happening in Washington today, where the overwhelming focus on both sides, we have both Democrats and Republicans saying we have to do whatever it is we can to cut the deficit. And other times when we focused on that, we eventually found that wasn't working and we got to where I think the two of you are today saying, no, what we need to do is take advantage of low interest rates and engage in more government spending to hire people and put them to work.
Now.
Yes. Yeah, I would agree. And if you think in one very basic way, I mean, think about the education system. Think of our K through 12 education system. Do you really want to decide the quality of the education system based on the current economic environment? So kids that go to, sorry, you went to school during a recession. You have big classes, and I'm sorry that, you know, so you're going to have a lower quality education
system. Because there's a lot of scientific evidence that as class sizes enlarge, student learning collapses.
And so, I mean, that's really one of the fundamental, you know, as far as a very basic way in terms of government spending and the jobs that Sam mentioned, as far as being cut out of the sector, and that in many ways, you know, we have these losses from the stimulus essentially prevented those losses, the stimulus package. And so they weren't noticeable to people, but they're going to be noticing them this year as they go to their town halls or go to hear about the school district budget. I know in our hometown of Lexington, we're dealing with that loss of stimulus spending.
Right, because it all dried up by the end of 2010. The stimulus money, which accounted for about 3 million jobs, was all spent out. So we don't have any stimulus money now.
It's absolutely wonderful that now all of our phone lines are busy, but we've only got a couple of more minutes before we run out of time. So let me see if I can get to at least a couple of these calls. Matthew in Broadway, thank you for joining us. If you could make a quick question or comment, please.
All right, I just wanted to share the story of my best friend, which is similar to someone who was in a field that was ejected from it and looking for low-level work, but he finished college right when this was starting up in 2007, and he wasn't able to find anything in his field. He was a qualified technical writer, but everyone could pick from the technical writers who had been laid off who had 10 or 15 years experience, and no one wanted a new technical writer with no actual work experience. So he spent 3 years without having a job, and he turned inward, as your guests were talking about. He spent a lot of time just on the internet reading and watching videos, and he kind of stopped interacting with people. But he was finally able to successfully find a job as a receptionist, so not in his field, and he's basically at a lower level than I'm at, and I just started working when I got out of high school. I do not have a college degree, and right now I'm better off than he is because I got into a job before the recession started.
And Matthew, again, I apologize for the fact that we're now short on time, but I appreciate you hanging on the line there and sharing that bit of your perspective with us. Let me see if we can fit one more call in before we run out completely. Ron in Charlottesville, you're on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for our guests, please. Economist Tim Diet and Art Goldsmith.
Yeah, quite simply stated, in my mind, it's incontrovertible that job creators are not going to magically create jobs when people don't have money to go out and spend. If you add more stimulus into the economy, give money to people who don't have money and have to spend it right back into the economy, that's how you create demand or people with money that they can spend. That's when the job creators can create more jobs because they will have more product to sell to people who can buy it.
Okay, Ron, you summed that up very well, well enough that we can fit one more caller in now. Next, we're going to Barry in Harrisonburg. Barry, you're going to be our last call here on Virginia Insight.
Well, thank you. And it's hard to sum up all my thoughts in 10 seconds or less, but I couldn't disagree more with that we need to spend more money to create jobs. I employ about 30 to 40 people, and my problem is continuing to create jobs because of all the regulations that's come across from the recent challenges with the Dodd-Frank, and I think that the stimulus package spending doesn't create any jobs at all. It's just wasteful spending. Instead of using the money where the people locally can direct that money to productive resources, just giving it away to people to buy things.
And Barry, excuse me for cutting you off because we are so short on time. I just want to make sure I understand. One, you're saying that government regulation is keeping you from creating more jobs, and two, that you think government spending is causing less jobs to be created across the U.S.
Yes, the government.
Okay, hold on just a second. Let's have just about 30 seconds for our guests to respond before we are completely out of time.
Barry, you're right about one thing for sure, and that is that local spending, state spending, and local spending is the primary area where jobs get generated. And in fact, virtually all of that stimulus money was block grants to state and local communities to spend on things like education, roads, penitentiaries, and things of that nature. This is a very interesting question about whether we're over-regulated or not.
And you've got 20 seconds to make your...
If regulation was the main source of the Great Recession, then we would have seen an increase in regulation in, let's say, 2006 and 7, and then the recession that followed. And, you know, that just hasn't been the case. So,
so from your perspective, back in the 1990s when the economy was humming, we had more regulation.
We actually had instituted a fair increase in regulation over that period, especially in the financial sector.
To all who called today, we do thank you for sharing your perspective. As divergent as it was, our guests have been Art Goldsmith and Tim Diet, both economists at Washington and Lee University, and both among the co-authors of a new nationwide report on the hidden costs of unemployment. Tim, Art, thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you.
Can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Insight Archives. And if you go to that page, you'll find links to more information about the work both of our guests are doing. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.